Right now, two pieces of state news to talk about. One, Governor Scott Walker submitted a plan to drug test able-bodied recipients of the state's food assistance program called Food Share. And then there's some breaking news this afternoon about an investigation into leaks in a John Doe probe. Jason Stein is with us to talk about both these things. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Good to be on the program.
We'll get to that food share story in just a minute, but some news that I didn't know was coming. Maybe other people did. About 2:30, I think it was, we saw results. I haven't looked at them myself. I've just been seeing tweets summing them up, Jason, into this a probe of a leak. Can you talk about what was being investigated here?
Sure. A couple years back, the Guardian newspaper received a leak of information related to the John Doe investigation into Governor Scott Walker's campaign that was ultimately halted by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And, you know, information then later came out from within that investigation. Attorney General Brad Schimmel ended up conducting an investigation into who had leaked that information, whether it was a crime, and the results came out today.
And what were some of the highlights of this? I know there's probably a lot there, and people are still digging through it, but what did we see in broad strokes so far?
Well, the 90-page report basically stated that investigators concluded that it was a crime when this information got leaked and that they will never be able to prove who did it, basically because the evidence from the investigation was not very well secure. So a lot of people either had access to it or potentially had access to it. But the Attorney General is seeking some sort of non-criminal penalties for some people involved in the investigation conducting it for what he views as a violation of a judge's order to stop examining certain evidence that they had collected from Republican targets.
And then there's some people have summed this up as there was John Doe 1 and John Doe 2, the first one about largely Governor Walker's campaign, John Doe 2 about supposed coordination between that campaign and separate groups. People are saying there's a John Doe 3. What do they mean by that?
Okay, so one clarification. I would say John Doe 1, it involved various misconduct by employees of Milwaukee County at a time when the governor was
the
elected county executive of Milwaukee. DOJ is basically saying that, is basically showing, I think, and demonstrating that these John Doe investigations were extremely broad and got a lot of information about Republicans in the state. And they're arguing that part of this investigation sort of amounts to a third investigation into a third John Doe investigation into Republicans. But the DOJ report doesn't really clearly state, if there was a third investigation, what crime exactly it was investigating. I mean, I think, you know, what is clear though is that the investigations that were there were pretty broad.
And the agency, as we wrap up this topic, the agency being investigated, the Government Accountability Board, doesn't exist anymore.
Correct. The recommendations are that either criminal contempt or, in one case, lawyer ethics sanctions should be brought against various current and former employees of the GAB and the Ethics and Elections Commission that the GAB was converted into.
And Jason, are we going to be seeing, I imagine we're going to see a lot of people reacting to this over the next couple of days. Are we seeing reaction from conservative or liberal groups, politicians, people maybe who are targets of this probe?
Sure. We've already seen, you know, some Republicans coming out saying, you know, that this is terrible and that they feel that the John Doe was a fishing expedition. So far, we have not gotten any reaction from the people that are Schimmel is seeking sanctions on. It's worth noting that the prosecutors were under a secrecy order. The whole thing was under a secrecy order, and the violation of that secrecy order is why we have this investigation in the first place. And so you know, they're understandably reticent to talk about it right now because, you know, arguably they're still bound by that secrecy order.
We're talking to Jason Stein from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're going to switch topics to our originally planned conversation, looking at Governor Walker's plan to drug test some recipients of food assistance in Wisconsin. By the way, you can join in with your thoughts on that plan at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's a good idea to administer drug tests to some food share recipients? Are you looking for a legal challenge? Have you received food share? What do you think of this idea? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Jason Stein is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're going to talk now about Governor Walker's plan to drug test able-bodied recipients of food share. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Good idea, bad idea. Have you received food share yourself now or at some point? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jason, flesh this out a little bit for us. What are the details of this proposal?
Well, first of all, you get to see what a varied plate we have here at the state capitol, from drug testing food stamp recipients to leak investigations.
Yeah.
So in this case, you know, the governor has a couple different proposals to drug test recipients of public benefits. And in this case, it involves able-bodied recipients of food stamps. It's a program that is now known as Food Share in Wisconsin and SNAP nationally. And, you know, initially the governor had sought some go-ahead from the Trump administration for this to make it clear that the state had the authority to do this. But, you know, ultimately that hasn't happened yet from the Trump administration, and the Walker administration said they felt they had the authority to move forward without that.
Right, and you write that the Obama administration had not been warm on this idea. They were going to maybe block that. Is that right?
Correct. And since the governor, you know, moved forward with this a few days ago, we have seen the Trump administration issue some guidance to states on SNAP programs, suggesting that they want to emphasize flexibility for states and the integrity of the programs against fraud. So, you know, reading between the lines a little bit, it might suggest that the Trump administration would look favorably on this action, or at least might be less inclined to stop it than the Obama administration had seemed.
And the Walker administration is saying this isn't a matter of you failed a drug test, you're off of food share, right? There's a next step there.
Yeah, there's more to it than that. So essentially, someone to lose or not receive food stamp benefits would have to be screened, be chosen to have a drug test, and then either refuse to take the drug test or take it, test positive, and then refuse treatment, or, you know, accept the treatment but not follow through with it. So essentially, if you were someone that tested positive but was willing to comply with the drug testing the treatment that the state would provide, then you would presumably still get your benefits.
Let's get a reaction from a caller now at 800-642-1234. David is on the line in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. I certainly support the measure if the testing will detect opioids and prescription medications whereby the recipient of food share doesn't have a prescription, meaning we are in the death throes of an opioid addiction in Wisconsin, and everyone, even small children who watch television, know that enabling someone who's addicted to drugs is a non-starter.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, David. And Jason, I know the governor has talked about this as a workforce issue, making people can pass a workplace drug test. Has he rolled in the concerns about the opioid epidemic into selling this idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair that the governor and Republicans have talked about that as you know, one of the reasons why this is a beneficial thing. I mean, I think the main thing they've said in arguing for this is that there aren't enough workers who can pass the drug test, and this is going to help with that. In terms of illicit versus prescription drugs, I think this is primarily targeted at illicit drugs.
And what have we been hearing from people who work on hunger issues about their thoughts on this idea?
Well, they feel that it's illegal. They feel that it's not allowed under federal law, and that it will be expensive, and that it will have very little practical impact, because most people won't be tested, and most of the people that will be tested will not test positive. I think it's worth noting that I believe the Walker administration estimated that they would have 224 people test positive in the first year, I believe is the number that they came up with. So, you know, again, while at least a couple thousand people might have to take drug tests, the practical impact of this may be much smaller than the rhetoric over it on both sides.
I'll go to another caller. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Yeah, I know you guys are talking back and forth about the efficacy of this program, but let's face it, most of the states who have done things similar to this have found it to be practically worthless, and we are neglecting the fact that we're talking about constitutional rights here. We're talking about search. We're talking about being presumed guilty until proven innocent, and I'm always amazed when Republicans want to throw their Constitution underneath the bus when they profess to love it so much.
Tom, thanks for the call. And Jason, you were mentioning just a few moments ago that there were constitutional objections. Is this going to end up in the courts, do you think?
I think very likely, yes. If the administration does move forward, then it will end up in the federal courts. And I think one of the arguments will be that it, you know, constitutes an illegal, improper search by the government. You know, the argument, I think, on the other side, the other side is going to make, the supporters of this will make the argument that there's a difference between asking someone to submit to a search in exchange for a benefit as opposed to, you know, the government searching your home or office when you had not been asking the government for anything in the first place. So, you know, those will be some of the legal arguments that will play out, and I think it's very likely that we'll get to eventually see a court's ruling on this.
And briefly, Jason, courts aside, what's the governor's goal for a timeline?
It's still a ways off. There's 120 days, I believe, for the legislature to object to this rule. If they do not object to it, then it would go into place, but even then, it would not be immediately implemented. I think it's at least a year before, you know, the administration attempts to, you know, drug test someone, and I think, you know, we could very well end up in court before, you know, that actual testing ever happens. So it could be some time before, you know, someone that is seeking food stamp benefits actually gives a drug sample.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Jason Stein, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We were talking there about the idea of drug testing able-bodied recipients of the state's food assistance program. You can support conversations like this one and many, many more with your pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. CVS Pharmacy announced this weekend that it would buy the nation's third largest health insurer, Aetna, for $69 billion. The merger would still need to be approved and could face challenges along the way. But if this deal does go through, the move could have a significant impact on the healthcare industry as we know it now. Carolyn Johnson joins us. She's a business reporter for The Washington Post, where she covers the health industry. Carolyn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, part of why this is a big deal, I didn't even get it at first. When we think CVS, we think the corner drugstores around the country. They're a lot more than that, aren't they? They're this thing called a pharmacy benefit manager. What is that?
Yeah, so most people do know CVS as the drugstore that they go to with aisles of consumer goods, but they make a lot of money from pharmacy benefit management, which is something they do for insurers or for employers where they negotiate drug prices. So these are these like invisible to us middlemen who are designing kind of like the structure of your prescription drug benefit plan. So when you go and something is covered or not covered, or a copay is bigger or smaller. That's the kind of work that a pharmacy benefit manager does, and it's become a huge business.
So this merger would mean a big pharmacy chain, a big pharmacy benefit manager, those are both CVS, and now Aetna, a big, what, the third biggest insurance provider in the country. So what would this consolidation look like? What could this company do?
Well, according to the companies who are trying to kind of paint the picture of possibility, they see this as a way to create a new front door for healthcare in America, is how they're putting it. So basically, Aetna is an insurer, so one of their main goals as an insurance company is to kind of control healthcare costs, make sure people are getting the right kind of healthcare and the right settings, not going to the emergency room for the sniffles or getting a surgery that doesn't actually help. So they want to combine that with CVS is kind of nationwide, bricks and mortar, 9,700 pharmacy locations, and sort of transform that beyond a store into some kind of community health hub where people could go for basic kind of health procedures, counseling from pharmacists or nurses, and just kind of follow-up care and kind of chronic disease management to kind of help people stay healthy, and also just stay out of the hospital or other more expensive care settings.
Would this involve, and I know there's probably a lot of details to iron out here, would this involve doctors and physician's assistants? You mentioned nurses in particular.
They're talking a lot about pharmacists and nurses and not doctors, which is really interesting. Doctors are already kind of a little uncomfortable, I think, about this, not opposing the merger, but still very curious what it means about their role. You could see how if you were a primary care doctor, this could be good. It could mean your patient with diabetes is getting kind of better counseling in between the times that you see them because they can go to this place that's in their neighborhood and maybe make sure they're really taking their drug or filling their prescription and get more kind of reminders on stuff like that. But you could also see doctors feeling displaced because, you know, these companies would prefer the patients to come to them and for them to kind of help channel them into the right healthcare areas. And a lot of doctors see that as their area and would feel worried that care might not be as good in that scenario. So it's all, a lot remains to be seen about what they do, about how they structure these places. But I think already you can see why there might be a little uneasiness from kind of the traditional healthcare system.
Now, consumers might watch this and wonder, okay, this is the insurance company that decides what I get compensated for, what I get covered, what I have to pay a copay for, and the person I'm actually buying the medication from at the pharmacy counter. Is this going to hurt me as a consumer if both of those are basically under the same corporation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that is the question about this merger. Will it have the kind of great effects that the companies are saying it will, where it will make everything more efficient, people will be better kind of navigated through the system with the aid of the insurer, or will it end up being more of a kind of a conflict between people who are seeking care and a company that's primary goal is to kind of make sure unnecessary care isn't being used, but unnecessary sometimes in healthcare is not a point of widespread agreement, as we already know since, you know, we've all had battles with our insurance company. I mean, these companies are saying they could be a lot smarter about how they design the benefits so that they might not have to use some of the really annoying tools that we all have now, like a copay or, you know, your doctor have to fill out 10 pages of paperwork just to get your medicine approved. So if they make it more easy to get essential medicine, there could be benefits. And if they make it harder for people to get things that they need because they're trying to control costs, it could be bad. So, I mean, I think those are the big questions that we're going to have to kind of see how this plays out a little bit.
We're talking about the healthcare industry with this new proposed merger buyout, CVS taking over the insurer Aetna. Carolyn Johnson is with us from the Washington Post. Couple points of background you wrote about in writing about this, Carolyn. One, there's this argument often in testimony before Congress over who's at fault for spiraling costs of certain medications, drug manufacturers blaming pharmacy benefit managers like CVS is, people at the counter wondering if it's the pharmacy's fault. There's a big blame game, and that plays into these mergers, doesn't it?
Well, there's just a lot of thought that this kind of pharmacy benefit management or this middleman industry is ripe for disruption because of the confusion you talked about. No one really understands how drug prices work. They're pretty complicated and involve a lot of different industries. And the last year or two has been kind of a merry-go-round of blame between all the different players, saying one industry is more to blame than another. And I think what that sort of has laid the groundwork for is, you know, something to change about that. Here is one kind of form of change where the insurer and the pharmacy benefit manager can become one company, which is already happening in health insurance. There's a large insurer, United Health Group, that does this well. And then there's also this kind of just swirling rumor mill about whether Amazon is going to enter. And it's like Amazon's almost become like this Rorschach test of what you think, you know, everyone has no idea what they'll do, but they have lots of ideas about what they could do to make it better. And it's kind of become, I don't know, like what people's hopes are almost is what they're projecting on, because we still don't really have any indication whether they're even going to enter the drug business. But you know, that's created as well this kind of reshuffling of players as people are responding to even just the threat of a disruptive competitor.
Right. That's anybody who sells anything to anyone, I think, at this point, is worried about what happens if Amazon gets into their market. So do you think we'll see more of these big mergers between various kinds of healthcare things, pharmacies, insurers, providers, whatever, to try to make sure they're big enough to compete with Amazon if that happens?
Yeah, and with each other. You know, I mean, United Health Group is a very big insurer, the largest one, and it today, in fact, announced a $4.9 billion deal to buy primary care clinics from DaVita, a company best known for its kidney dialysis centers. And so they are moving hard from sort of the traditional role of an insurer into also being a provider. And that's another way of trying to manage healthcare costs and make care more efficient. But it also creates this sort of similar, it's like a parallel kind of situation. And they already have had a large business of pharmacy benefit management and owning some clinics. But it just, everyone expects more of this. So it's going to be a busy coming weeks and months, I think.
Well, that makes the government reaction to CVS and Aetna, I imagine, really important. So is there a thought that the government might look at this and say no to the merger?
People are really unsure, I would say. People who normally know what they think about what will happen to a merger. This is an unusual kind of merger because it's not between two like companies. They do very different business and they don't compete with each other. So the threat isn't exactly that they'll combine and just drive up prices because there'll be fewer competitors, because they're really just kind of consolidating in a vertical way, not like sort of horizontal, which is how people think about it. So a lot of people are kind of looking at the recent challenge to the AT&T Time Warner merger, which is a similar structure, as a clue maybe the government is going to be concerned about a merger like this. And it's certainly true the government has been caring about these health insurance mergers, which failed last year, which included an Aetna proposed to merge with Humana, and it basically got shot down and eventually collapsed. So I'd say that people are wondering what's going to happen and aren't sure. It's certainly not the typical grounds on which you know, an antitrust case is built. So people are going to be watching very closely.
And Carolyn, you're covering what to my mind is probably the most complicated business in the United States. Is it going to get any simpler if we see these mergers and consolidations? Does it make it easier to figure out what's going on, or more complicated?
I don't know. I think everyone thinks healthcare will get simpler, but I'm not sure why it would, but who knows. And it sort of depends on, from a consumer point of view, what you mean. The recent shift towards high-deductible plans that saddle us with a lot of our costs up front has been a huge kind of long-term change in the structure of health insurance. And that is making it, that is actually making something that was confusing more, it's revealing how confusing it is. Because previously people just paid their copays and just went on with their lives and kind of their insurance did the rest behind the scenes for them. But now, because people are suddenly facing $1,000, $2,000, $6,000 deductible, they're learning how much the list price of their drug is, or the variation in price for like a MRI could be very, very different at one hospital or one imaging center versus another. And so a lot of the stuff in the healthcare system that is complex is now actually becoming complex for consumers in a way that it hasn't been. And I think that's why you're seeing a lot of this, I don't know, effort to change and find a way to make it work. I don't think the solution is to make consumers do more work, because it's already pretty confusing. So I hope that whatever comes out of this, you know, will be helpful to consumers and not just further put more of the onus on them.
Carolyn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Carolyn Johnson, reporter for The Washington Post, where she covers business and the business of health. She joined us today to talk about the potential merger of CVS Pharmacy, and it does a lot of other stuff too, as we just learned, and health insurer Aetna, and what impact that could have on the healthcare industry and consumers.